You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Michael Gerson was chief speechwriter for President Bush from 1999 until he left in the summer of 2006. He now works as a syndicated columnist for The Washington Post and Newsweek, and he's also a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. In his new book, Heroic Conservatism, Why Republicans Need to Embrace America's Ideals and Why They Deserve to Fail If They Don't, he warns that conservatism is in peril, drawing on his White House experiences to argue for a renewed idealism in domestic and foreign policy. The book is published by HarperOne, and I'm pleased that it brings Mr. Gerson to the show today. Hello.
Good to be with you.
So why did you leave the White House? Had you been upset by the way things were going for a while?
No, not so much as being upset or disillusioned, but after 5.5 years, it's a tiring job, and I had other opportunities, and it seemed like a natural time. I'd been with George Bush both in the campaign and in the White House for about 7 years, and that's pretty long for any staffer.
So. Well, the reason I asked, I guess, is in the book you do seem to be expressing discontent with the conduct of the war, although you don't seem to put the responsibility for the problems on the president.
Mm-hmm.
Many people, Harry Truman said, the buck stops here, but you don't feel that way? You feel it stopped with Donald Rumsfeld?
Well, actually, I think that there's plenty of blame to go around. I talk about that in the book. And it's true that I make the point that some of the issues and causes that I cared about in the White House got harder and harder to advocate because of financial constraints and other things. But it's one of the arguments, the reason I want to write myself and make arguments myself, and both in the Post but also in this book. I believe that it's possible to be an economic conservative and also believe in an active moral foreign policy that helps African kids. I believe it's possible to be a social conservative and care about issues of wealth and poverty in the United States. And I think the Republican Party and the conservative movement have both a moral interest and a political interest in addressing those kind of issues. And right now, there's a significant backlash against those ideals.
Yeah, you argue that deepening public discontent with the Republican Party coupled with perpetual squabbling among conservative leaders is leading to decline and failure of the conservative movement. Right. What do you see are the chief complaints the public has against the Republican Party now?
Well, right now, if you look at the Republican debates, and it's part of my job to do that, there are very few people addressing middle-class economic issues, addressing issues of race and poverty, as I mentioned, addressing international issues that I believe are quite important about development and disease.
And we'll get to all of those things.
And the Republican Party is leading right now with, I think, a fairly narrow vision designed to appeal to its base instead of to do outreach to the large middle ground of American voters. I think there are real problems with that. I don't think that's the way George Bush won in 2000, and I recount some of that story. I don't think it's the way Bill Clinton won his first election.
But usually what happens is that parties appeal to their base when they're trying to establish which candidate is going to run, and then appeal to the broadest possible audience when they are running, and then try to work some kind of middle ground. The sense has been during the Bush administration that the administration has focused only on its base, and many people blame Karl Rove for those strategies.
Well, I dispute that at least in part.
Well, you're allowed
initially.
To. That's it,
right? Yeah. The reality there is on some key issues like the Medicare prescription drug benefit, like education reform, like the president's AIDS initiative in Africa, like immigration. The president, in a certain way, challenged the consensus of his party, and I think in some rather important ways. But I would also disagree in one way with the initial analysis. When Bill Clinton ran, he was talking, he was pro-death penalty and for welfare reform even during the primaries. When George W. Bush ran, he was talking about compassionate conservatism and immigration reform and these other issues during the primaries. It's very hard, I believe, to run in a very narrow way in the primaries and not create durable and difficult image problems going into the general election. I think that's what Republicans are doing right now.
Did you come up with the phrase compassionate conservatism?
No, but
because it was in a speech that you wrote.
Yeah, no, I think it preexisted me, but I was certainly involved on Capitol Hill in many ways in the creation of the policy ideas, initial policy ideas on the domestic side behind that movement, particularly looking at ways to promote the work of community and faith-based institutions to meet human needs without building kind of large centralized bureaucracies. And that was one of Governor Bush's main themes running in the year 2000. Those were a tough set of issues in Washington, and that was frustrating. The Republican leadership of Congress had almost no interest in these issues of any kind.
Well, you say there are two major traditions of conservative thought that you wanted to look at in this book: anti-government libertarianism and a narrowly focused religious model. Right. And they're obviously at loggerheads with each other.
Well, actually, I define the second one. I'm not a Catholic, but Catholic social thought is the main expression of that religious model, a concern for solidarity, which is solidarity with the poor and weak, and subsidiarity, which means that these local institutions, should be the primary instrument by which we provide those services and encourage, caring for one another. I think that those are the two main intellectual traditions kind of contending for the soul of the Republican Party right now. They lead to very different conclusions. One is deeply anti-government. It was most obvious in 1994 with the kind of army delay approach in the Republican Party.
It took Dick Armey.
Right, Dick Armey. And the argument I make for a kind of compassionate or heroic conservatism is really influenced by I define it as a conservatism of the common good. It's trying to use conservative and free market ideas to help real people, whether it's the poor or addicts or people abroad that are in need of help. And that seems to me a more promising both morally and politically.
But you're an evangelical Christian. Mm-hmm. That is, most people would see that as the major religious strain right now affecting the Republican Party, not an older Catholic idealism.
But I actually argue that's I think it's true, but it's also the content of that approach, that religious approach to politics, is changing significantly. You have so many more evangelicals that are motivated on African issues of racial justice, economic issues. There's been a broadening, a real broadening beyond the narrow concerns of the religious right on a number of these issues. When I was at the White House, and evangelical leaders would contact me, it was more often than not on issues like Darfur and genocide, issues like AIDS, issues like malaria. That's, I think, an important and positive shift going on in America. You're seeing a large generational shift between the generation of Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson and the generation of Rick Warren. It's a major change.
My guest is Michael J. Gerson, who's written a book called Heroic Conservatism: Why Republicans Need to Embrace America's Ideals and Why They Deserve to Fail If They Don't. It's published by Harper One. So let's talk about some of those things. AIDS to Africa. Well, wasn't that sent with some strings attached?
There were some strings attached there. There was a kind of small set aside for abstinence-based programs.
And also it wouldn't provide funds to any organization that supported abortion rights.
Yeah.
So that really limited who that money could get to, didn't
it? Yeah, but
it?
The innovation of the program, of course, was actually providing ARVs, antiretroviral drugs, to people who were dying in Africa, and we're moving towards the provision of those drugs for 2 million people, which has really changed the whole atmosphere on this. People didn't seek testing in a lot of these settings because it was hopeless. And now that there's availability of drugs, you have an increase in testing. But I think it's wrong to argue that somehow the administration did not emphasize prevention, including condoms. I mean, in the first 4 years of the program, there was a 70% increase in condom distribution in the focus countries. And African approaches to this issue, when you get down on the ground and you visit Kenya or you visit Namibia or you visit South Africa, it's really what they call A, B, and C, which is abstinence, be faithful within relationships, and consistent condom use in high-risk sex. They emphasize all three of those elements, and I think that the administration has effectively supported all three.
You also cite Darfur as a success. Doesn't fighting continue in Darfur? Aren't there thousands and thousands of refugees living in other parts of Sudan and across the border in Chad?
I certainly would not count that as a complete success. It's been a success only in the sense of getting the United Nations Security Council to approve a new force for which is supposed to begin kind of bulking up by the end of the year. That was a major, I think, administration victory, but we've yet to see the results on the ground. I've been to Darfur. I've been to the, seen the villages, seen the genocide there, the 2 million people in camps. And right now, the biggest need is this kind of stable security environment so people can begin to return to their homes and start to plant crops. The problem has been that the government in Khartoum has significantly restricted the ability to provide that security, and they're going to be tested in the next few months because the UN has approved a 20,000 force to move in, and I hope that there's better results there.
Were these programs difficult to get conservatives to sign on to?
Well, I would have to say on the AIDS front, not very, because it was a very popular issue even with more conservative members of the Congress. But, you know, one of my most disappointing experiences at the White House was in the aftermath of Katrina, and I talk about it in the book. When I went down with the president, we saw people, we were attempting to help people down there who had never had a bank account, that had no connection to the mainstream economy of any kind. And in the aftermath of that storm, Democrats, I found at the national level, were mainly interested in the apportionment of blame, and Republicans were mainly interested in budget offsets. And there were very few people in our political system that wanted to confront these deep and durable problems of race and poverty in America. That, to me, was disappointing. And I think it's something we eventually have to confront. You know, we often have events like the LA riots or Katrina that reveal these problems. And then they go away in the public mind, but they don't really go away. And I think our political class needs to be more focused on those issues. And I don't think you'll find much discussion at either party right now.
Well, around the country, food banks reported today that they won't be able to meet the increased demand for assistance. And it's not just from the unemployed and poor. They're seeing more families with jobs
right.
who need assistance. And New Orleans has definitely not recovered as a result of
what
happened in Katrina. And many people have pointed out that it isn't that that money wasn't sent. It was just sent in the most inefficient way possible, that it was applied to the wrong kinds of programs. And they put a fair amount of responsibility for that on the ineptitude. The word ineptitude has been applied an awful lot of the Bush administration
and its
agencies.
I think that there have been, certainly you saw initial ineptitude at FEMA. You've seen some problems with the Small Business Administration. You've also, of course, seen a lot of problems with the state and local level. We're not prepared in many ways to distribute this kind of aid. But, you know, the problem is not so much just getting help to people, in an emergency. The question is how we're going to encourage social mobility for people that have remained in this kind of situation for a long time. And that's going to take innovative ideas from both parties. And I think conservatives have something to offer there to encourage savings, to encourage wealth creation, empower individuals and communities to confront some of these problems. I think there's going to have to be a lot more done in both parties.
Well, you argue in the book that conservatism without idealism and compassion is dead, and that only a heroic conservative can appeal to the conscience, inspire the nation, and engage the world. Mm-hmm. And many people feel that President Bush has abandoned the idealism, has abandoned the compassion for sure. Do you understand why many Americans now feel his leadership has not inspired them or engaged the world?
Well, there are some. I would push back in one way. I would say that Iraq has in many ways overshadowed some of the accomplishments of the administration, but it hasn't eliminated them. There are tens of millions of people getting prescription drugs in Medicare. There are, minority students, their performance is improving for the first time in decades because of No Child Left Behind. You know, the AIDS program, the malaria program are in effect. These things are good things. But I do talk, there's a mixed record here with an uncooperative Congress, with a Republican leadership that was, as far as I could tell, very uninterested in these issues. And so I think the book, although not a tell-all, is honest about those things.
Well, we'll take a little break, and when we come back, we will continue this conversation with Michael J. Gerson, whose book, Heroic Conservatism, Why Republicans Need to Embrace America's Ideals and Why They Deserve to Fail If They Don't, published by Harper One. But let's go out with a little clip from a speech that you wrote for President Bush.
So it is the policy of the United States to seek and support the growth of democratic movements and institutions in every nation and culture with the ultimate goal of ending tyranny in our world. The advance of human freedom, the great achievement of our time and the great hope of every time, now depends on us. Our nation, this generation, will lift a dark threat of violence from our people and our future. We will rally the world to this cause by our efforts, by our courage. We will not tire, we will not falter, and we will not fail.
Stirring words from President Bush, written by Michael J. Gerson, who has written a book now called Heroic Conservatism, Why Republicans Need to Embrace America's Ideals and Why They Deserve to Fail If They Don't, published by Harper One. Those words seem so at variance with the way things are. We're supporting President Musharraf of Pakistan, not one of the most responsible supporters of democracy in the world. The situation in Iraq doesn't seem to be leading to any kind of a viable democracy. Afghanistan has a very seriously troubled government. Are those the sorts of things that you write to stir people up, or do you actually believe in them when you write them?
Well, I strongly believe in them, and Pakistan is an interesting example. This is a case where many people from the kind of realist foreign policy tradition declared the president's democracy agenda to be a dangerous, radical failure. And now, of course, the main criticism is that the president isn't living up to it in Pakistan. And I do think that there have been some problems in the last few years not using American leverage to try to encourage rule of law, election, strong parties, all these kind of institutional framework of democratic institutions in Pakistan. In fact, I'm going to write about that this week. So the need here is actually for a more consistent application of that agenda in many ways. Iraq, I guess I would dispute in one way. I do think that there are some bottom-up signs of reconciliation in that country that are much more hopeful than we might have seen six months ago.
You don't see total division in a country that once was largely secular, now largely divided between Kurds, Shiites, and Sunnis?
I see some real failures, particularly in kind of the centralized national leadership. But I also see, I think the real news of the last 6 months is that you're having significant reconciliation at the grassroots level. And you hope that that filters its way up the system. It's hopeful. I think there's a decent shot at a decent outcome. I wouldn't have said that 6 months ago. But is that the fault of the democracy agenda? See, I argue in the book that there were significant problems and failures in the immediate aftermath of the war that allowed essentially chaos to reign in Baghdad and other places, creating habits of violence that we're still dealing with to this day. And I think that there were some things that we could have done about that. But that, to me, does not say that democracy has failed. It says that it's very hard to build a democracy in an atmosphere of chaos and disorder.
But let me see if I can understand what you're saying. So we should have gone into Iraq because we would be spreading democracy. But why then not go into Myanmar? There are so many countries that are undemocratic in the world. Is that what the United States, is that the new ideal of heroic conservatism
to attack every
country that is an awful dictatorship and impose what our idea of what democracy is?
No, absolutely not. Iraq was a case where we strongly believed that there was a national security threat. It coincided with a desire to promote democracy. I think the imposition in that country of a Shia strongman would have been disastrous and maybe even led to genocide. Very much the same with Afghanistan. Once we took that action, which was of course dictated by historical events, not necessarily the promotion of democracy, I think we had very little choice but to promote democracy in that circumstance. But I don't believe that the only alternative here is to promote freedom through force. In fact, I make a strong argument in the book that some of the best ways that we can encourage alternatives to bitterness, resentment, and dangerous ideologies are through the development and fighting disease and a lot of other areas that the administration, once again, has not not gotten much credit for. You know, the president more than doubled development assistance in his time as president, more than tripled aid to Africa, which was a fairly extraordinary change. I think we need more of it in a lot of different places. But I do believe that America can be actively involved, not through military force, but through diplomatic and economic pressure in places like Burma and Zimbabwe and North Korea.
Many conservatives have been upset by the negotiations with North Korea.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I think that there may be not. First of all, with a nuclear power, many of your options are constrained, and that's just a reality of history. But I think there could be more emphasis on the human rights situation there, which is Stalinist in many ways. You know, countries like South Korea have downplayed those elements in a desire to, I think, in not very effective foreign policy approach. I think these countries in some ways should be shamed, not invaded.
Well, there has Seymour Hersh and others have written about plans to go after Iran as well. Right now, just kind of held in check, but not impossible to imagine.
I have no inside information on this, and maybe Hersh might. I see very little preparation of the public for such a thing. I think the clear course the administration has taken is to work with allies, European allies, and the Russians, to try to increase the level of economic pressure on Iran. And I think that's probably what most foreign policy experts would do in this circumstance.
What about the economy? Republicans usually were very good on the economy, but we forget about the fact that we have this growing deficit. We now have the dollar weakening to a point where I just came back from Europe, and now the euro, I think, is almost $1.50, mm-hmm. Whereas just a year and a half ago, it was below a dollar. There are many people predicting recession. Is none of this the responsibility of poor economic planning by the Bush administration?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's easy to make those accusations after 8 million new jobs produced and, you know, 4.6% unemployment and a kind of relatively long period of significant economic growth.
All those figures have been, you know, can be argued to the end of time. Different economists.
Well, I don't think you can argue the figures, but I do think that there are some long-term fundamental problems with the American economy that Republicans need to address. I think that, you know, we're seeing recent information that income mobility is actually slowed in America. That's a real concern. But through generations, the ability to move up the economic ladder, particularly among African Americans, and a few candidates. I think people like Mike Huckabee have addressed those issues. I think some Democrats have addressed them. But yeah, I think we have long term economic challenges here. I think a weaker dollar, if it happens gradually, actually increases exports. It's not necessarily a disastrous economic situation.
But that's if we have things to export.
Well, but if we have a rapidly declining dollar that shakes confidence in the American economy, then I think it's a genuine problem. So, I mean, clearly there are difficulties with prices of fuel and the credit crunch, rooted in a lot of kind of fairly bad lending practices, and those things need to be addressed. I think both either candidate eventually is going to have to speak to those issues.
My guest is Michael J. Gerson, who's written a book called Heroic Conservatism, Why Republicans Need to Embrace America's Ideals and Why They Deserve to Fail If They Don't. It's published by Harper One. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. One of the problems, some people say, is that the White House was rather arrogant in its relations with its potential European allies and only recently have been willing to work with them, but have alienated a fair number, although I guess with Sarkozy in France
and Germany.
Yeah, and Merkel in Germany, perhaps they'll be talking to friendlier voices, friendlier ears.
Well, it was certainly not true with Tony Blair, who was very, very close. But there was certainly significant tension with Chirac and Schroeder. I'm not sure. I think that had been developing even during the Clinton years.
Well, nobody was talking about freedom fries during the Clinton years.
No, that's true. But that came in the aftermath of essentially the French absolutely refusing to be helpful in a lot of different ways. I mean,
the war in Iraq.
It's hard to deal with. You have to try to deal with that diplomatically, but you really have to take two to tango there. And France, I think, adopted an attitude that they wanted to be a counterbalance to American power instead of helping in a variety of issues and not just Iraq. I think that's changed significantly. I think they're involved in important ways now. For example, on Darfur. I think that they're involved in important ways on the Iranian negotiations. There was some significant tension. It was really very Iraq-related. But even during that time, which most people don't recognize, that in the daily cooperation in going after terrorist suspects and arresting some very bad people, that France and Germany were both very supportive.
You spoke approvingly of Franklin Delano Roosevelt to Chris Matthews recently. Would mm-hmm. you like to see conservatives embrace an updated version of the New Deal?
Not necessarily the New Deal, but certainly a kind of moral internationalism in foreign affairs. That Roosevelt adopted. He was also accused of hypocrisy, of announcing the Four Freedoms and then having a close relationship with Stalin. But he was very clear about
America. And ignoring the plight of the Jews who were dying in the Holocaust.
And some of that criticism was justified. But he set out a very, very clear vision, which I think is the mainstream of American foreign policy, which is a kind of liberal internationalism, that America benefits from the advance of trade, economic freedom, rule of law, women's rights, all around the world, and that we should take an active, not confrontational role, but active role in promoting those ideals and values because it's in our interest and because it fits our kind of the moral framework of the American founding. I find that true in Roosevelt and Truman and John Kennedy and elements of Reagan, elements of Bush, and I don't think that's a tradition that we can abandon just because, Iraq has not gone exactly the way that we wanted.
You've said that your first political hero was Jimmy Carter.
It was. The president that I've first shook his hand was in St. Louis, was Jimmy Carter. He represented a kind of emphasis on human rights, a moral foreign policy that was a contrast to the Nixon years. He also
was criticized by Ronald Reagan and Gene Kirkpatrick and many other people in the Republican Party.
No, I agree with that. But he also was actually very forthright about his faith, which attracted many people from my background. And I actually found that the Democratic Party it didn't represent that tradition in the few elections that followed and really turned off a lot of people from my tradition. But I sense even at the White House, it was actually one of the honors. I got to talk and know Jimmy Carter a little bit on UN reform and some other issues. And he, of course, is very involved on many of these African issues through the Carter Foundation, as is Bill Clinton. I do want to say that on in one of the most bitter and polarized periods of American political history, this recent times, I found some really strange and interesting ideological alliances on issues like Darfur and Africa and malaria. I work closely with the Gates Foundation. I work closely with Bono on a variety of issues, and it's still involved with the One Campaign, the 108 campaign. I think that it's possible on some of these moral international commitments and some domestic commitments to move beyond some of these divisions and have a politics that's oriented not towards our interests, not towards our conflicts, but also towards our aspirations.
Well, what about religion? You mentioned faith and faith-based groups. You also, in one of your columns, you approvingly quoted Mike Huckabee as saying, I'm mm-hmm. a conservative, but if that means I have to close my eyes to poverty and hunger, I'm not going to do that. Mm-hmm. He is a clergyman. Right. You mentioned in the book that you supported President Bush's claim that Jesus Christ was his favorite philosopher, which upset mm-hmm. many Americans in a country that is supposedly a secular nation.
Right. Well, I'm not sure that I buy the argument. America is a nation that...
Are we a Christian nation?
No, absolutely
Many
not.
Many conservatives claim that.
Absolutely not. We're a nation that disestablishes religion, that has a constitutional order that's not directly based on any sectarian belief. If we were to remove the role of religious conscience in American history, we would remove the abolition movement. We would remove the movements to improve working conditions during the Industrial Revolution. We would remove the civil rights movement. We would remove the pro-life movement, which I strongly support. These are, you know, have been some of the best things about American history. And they have been movements of conscience, not rooted in sectarian beliefs, but in a certain view of human rights and dignity rooted in faith. That's still true today for many Americans. This is their prime motivation. They believe in human rights. They believe in human dignity because they believe that human beings are created in God's image. That anthropology, not some kind of what theologians call soteriology, some theory of salvation, that's not politically relevant. But an anthropology, a view of humans' rights and their dignity, is very relevant and remains relevant in our
Well,
time.
Later we will be talking with somebody else about whether the Bush administration has politicized science to the point where it has crossed out all sorts of things from reports because it didn't go along with certain religious beliefs. But I can't let you go without at least mentioning Matthew Scully's article for Atlantic Monthly about working with you. He doesn't paint a very flattering picture, and you write for 7 years talking about him and John McConnell. These two speechwriters would be my friends and partners, and hardly a crossword ever passed between us. Did you know that Scully was mad about you all the time? Was that angry with you?
It came as a complete surprise.
Have you spoken to him about it?
No, I haven't. I haven't yet. And it was. But the one thing that I strongly agree with about Matt's article that he wrote is that he did play an absolutely essential role in many of these. We often wrote as a team. And
is he still writing for the president?
No, Matt is not. He's not right now. And both of them, Matt Scully and John McConnell, are some of the best writers and finest people I've ever known.
Mm-hmm. So how much input do speechwriters actually have in the creation of policy? Because, you know, you could make a really nice phrase like axis of evil, and the next thing you know, the whole world is turned upside down.
Well, it is the role of a speechwriter to come up with vivid phrases that express the president's interests and approaches. But the reality there is that it's, and not just within the speechwriting department, but broadly in the White House, it's a process where the whole senior staff is confronted. Everyone reads the speech in the various departments. You can't get away with slipping things in speeches. These things are done by a broad group of people. These are consensus documents. So a speechwriter has the ability to propose language, but of course he doesn't determine the outcomes of this process. That's done, you know, by the senior staff of the White House, who read the speeches and comment on them. But then it's eventually done by the president, who was very active in this process and pretty much left an imprint on every word.
Michael J. Gerson, who is now writing for The Washington Post and Newsweek and is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He has been a speechwriter for President George W. Bush, also for presidential candidates Senator Bob Dole and Senator Dan Coats. He has written a book called Heroic Conservatism. Will you be writing for Mike Huckabee?
Goodness, no. I'm out of politics forever. So
forever? Wow.
Yes. I'm a journalist now. I do a twice a week commentary for the Post.
We'll see what forever means. it's an addictive thing, isn't it, politics?
It is. And I was involved in the last three presidential campaigns, and I write about that, but I also love opinion journalism.
Heroic Conservatism, Why Republicans Need to Embrace America's Ideals and Why They Deserve to Fail If They Don't, is published by Harper One. Thank you so much for being with us.
Great to be with you.